call is now being recorded.
Hello, everyone. This is Alon Gannon with Being Libertarian. I am here with Dr. Petrakis, a very well-known attorney in Central Ohio. He is well-known as Fraudbuster Bob, been at the center of discovering many of the scandals that have plagued our local city politics. He's currently running for the Franklin County Prosecutor under the Green Party. How are you doing, Dr. Petrakis?
Oh, I'm doing well, Alon.
That's great to hear. So I hear you have an interesting story about basically how you decided to run. My understanding is Ron O'Brien was going to run unopposed. That's the Franklin County prosecutor for Ohio, currently under the Republican Party. But it seemed like you weren't going to have any of that.
Well, you know, with the recent controversies over the police and police shootings and also, you know, the rise of the surveillance state as well as the attacks, in my mind, on the Bill of Rights, there was no way I was going to be there.
I'm sorry, you broke up at the end.
Oh, I wasn't going to let Ron O'Brien run unopposed, which he has for the last 16 years, the last four elections. So I got into the race as a Green for prosecutor, which is arguably, I think, the most important position in the county.
Definitely. And then I understood that after you threw your hat in the ring, you basically kind of embarrassed the Democrat Party because they now had no candidate, and here the Republican Party was going to be opposed, not by the other of the major two parties, but by the Green Party. And they apparently had thrown up Zach Klein, whom by many accounts is unqualified for the position. What do you think about that whole situation with the Democrats?
Well, it's extremely odd, as you know. Number one, he had just won for re-election. And, of course, Andy Ginther had moved from city council president to a situation where Klein was now the acting city council president, the second most important position in the city, heir apparent to the mayor, and before he wins the election, but before he's sworn in, he files for county prosecutor, even though he's never, ever filed a single paper or argued anything in a court of law.
That is definitely most interesting. I mean, we've seen even in your private life that you've definitely stood up for the rights of the people and taken it to the man, as we say. I've been reading through some of your past cases. One of the ones of my favorite that you took to court was about the election machine, the voting machines. And my understanding was you couldn't really get them to show what's in there because their code is proprietary, which, me being a free, libre, and open source software advocate, I've been saying for years that is the Achilles heel of our democracy. We can put these voting machines in, and no one knows how they operate. I wanted to know what your personal thoughts about that whole outcome of the case were.
Well, yeah, that case, which I was a plaintiff in, but I've filed other cases, and I'm now filing papers in Ohio. You'll appreciate this. They've been disabling the audit logs on the high-speed scanners that count the scanned ballots, the ones you mark and they scan, and they've been turning off the ballot image backup system, which creates an electronic image of every ballot, and literally you have to disable that. So why wouldn't you want an electronic ballot image also with an audit log that puts the images sequentially and shows you every mark to match against the actual ballots? So that's part of the problem right there. But you're absolutely right. Why the democracy would you allow a private partisan for-profit entity to secretly count the ballots and tabulate the ballots with proprietary software that no one can look at when you could easily use open source.
Definitely. I know I've actually spoken to Richard Stallman at times, the founder of the Free Software Movement, about free Libre software. He's also another Green Party member, so it's really nice to see, you know, that there's a lot of people that are well-known in the IT life as well as in the regular civilian life, such as you, that are taking the government to task and trying to hold them definitely accountable. Now, you mentioned a while back about Andy Ginther. We did have the recent scandals with Mayor Coleman. I know we privately have spoken about that, but what do you think about Andrew Ginther coming in as the, you know, new Democrat mayor, basically being hand-picked by Coleman, and it seemed more like passing the torch than having an election here?
Well, you know, both of them were caught up in the Red Flex camera. I know you're familiar with it, but they operated like the mob, right? They have these automated cameras, and if you're crossing, you know, at a light and your car is over the line or the light looks like it's red, they give you a ticket without any human involvement. For example, I know you went to Columbus State, but I actually received a few of these from activity at Columbus State. I recall during the first week of classes in the fall in particular, there's traffic jams and there's police officers. So if you're out in the intersection and they tell you to stop, the light's going to change and the camera would take a picture of you. And the camera doesn't, you know, distinguish. Yeah, a traffic jam where you're not allowed to go anywhere or somebody running a red light. And then they would write you a letter, and you had to send them $95, or they would turn it over to the court system and the prosecutor. Right? It was like extortion, because even if you beat that ticket, you know, your insurance company is going to raise your insurance more than $95. So it, of course, was ruled unconstitutional. But the company that installed those in Columbus, two of their corporate officials were charged and convicted of bribing a public official in Columbus. And the lobbyist for Andy Ginther and the mayor, John Rayfield, was convicted of being a bagman and facilitating a bribery of a public official. Now, here's the problem. You've got the bagman, the middleman, John Rayfield. You've got two corporate officials convicted of bribing a public official. And, of course, we know what's missing. Where's the public official? Which, my understanding, was Andy Ginther they were looking at, and Mayor Coleman. Ginther in particular, it looks like, you know, $20,000 or so was sent by Red Flex to the Democratic Party, which then sent it back to the Ginther campaign. So,
you're talking about the state party, local party, or national?
State party.
Okay.
You know, they just kind of sent the money there, and then the money came back almost immediately, and the their lobbyist middleman called it a success fee. So, and that was right after the company got this, you know, unbid contract for cameras. So one of the reasons I was running was to find out who that public official was and rightly put the corrupt individual behind bars.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like you're kind of describing to us Columbus, Ohio, you know, basically Kasich's own backyard. I mean, his mansion's right in Bexley, which is near it, as basically being the modern Tammany Hall of Ohio. Would that be correct?
Well, yeah, and it's it is the modern high-tech Tammany in part because it's a one-party system. the same thing that really originally brought you Tammany Hall. When you have one party, in a Democratic Party, that's very interested in raising, you know, the large sums of money you need to run for office. I saw today that, again, Zach Klein has spent nearly $1 million on the prosecutor's race, as has Ron O'Brien. I'm still somewhere around $700, even though we've been, you know, passing out literature and passing out yard signs and, you know, marching and speaking out and, you know, demonstrating at City Hall. But when you spend that much money and people give you large donations, they're going to expect something from the prosecutor. And I suspect they'll want you to look the other way on some of their questionable activities.
No, definitely. I mean, going on to your Black Lives Matter, you know, stances, I know we recently had a case of our own. There was a young child shot by the police. His name escapes me for some reason.
Tyree King, the 13-year-old, was shot a block from my house here on by East Broad Street.
Right, that's the one I was thinking of, and I know there was a lot going on with that case. Unfortunately, you know, with cases like that, there's so much that went on. So what exactly happened with that case, and was the police in any wrongdoing in this?
Well, Tyree King was 13. He was, according to the coroner, about 5'1", 100 pounds. You know, very you know, small 13-year-old. And the police, the official version is the 13-year-old had a BB gun on him that looked like a real gun. And when the police told him to, you know, stop, that he pulled a BB gun against a police officer's real weapon and threatened him. And he was then justifiably shot dead. The problem we got is there's an independent coroner out of Detroit that looked at the situation and said, you know, he was shot in the back. He was shot running away. He wasn't facing the police officer with a gun. They haven't produced the gun yet, although they did produce kind of a sketch of the gun. But there also was an 18-year-old involved with the stop, and the 18-year-old says that the police officer was using the N-word. Also, the officer involved, Officer Mason, this is his fourth shooting. This is the second person he's killed, and two others he shot. So the question often becomes, if you're shooting that many times, which is abnormal for the average police officer,
let alone Columbus, it's not that dangerous of an area.
No, no. And in fact, the data indicates, you know, we're the safest big city in America. Now, they'll say that's because of their police. I think it's because it's Columbus, right? It has a relatively low unemployment rate. It doesn't have kind of
a very great socioeconomic status, very great diversity. I mean, we have one of the largest Somali communities. So I think it's just Columbus is very well at just blending together and just being responsible. I don't think it really, as you said, has anything to do with the police. I think it just has to do more with the people and how we act here.
Yeah, and many people here were stunned by a 13-year-old juvenile being shot to death while apparently running away from the police. Now, if you look at statistics, and, you know, I use the term Black Lives Matter because of statistics, in the same way I would hope that all of us, if we were around in the 1930s, would have said Jewish Lives Matter. Usually, who's ever being victimized at a particular time, you should rise to their defense. And in this case, for every juvenile who's black between the ages of 13 and 17, if you look at the comparison, 34 black juveniles are shot for every one white juvenile that's shot. For some reason, I expect it's cultural or training or biased or profiling. The police are far more likely, in fact, 34 times as likely to shoot a black youth 13 to 17 than they are a white youth.
Hmm. Which is kind of interesting, seeing as when you look at the statistics of how many black people there are in America, it's rather low. I think it's like something, correct me if I'm wrong, it's like close to 13% of the total population.
Right, yeah, that's correct.
Right. It's not very high, so statistically, it seems to be illogical, if that makes sense.
No. Statistically, it's not random. It's not natural. Something is at work beyond the notion of simple police work. There seems to be an acceptance or tendency, I suspect, because of stereotypes, because of fear, because of, you know, what the media portrays with gangster rap, that the police, who are overwhelmingly white and don't really live in the city, not even in the county, they in many ways live in rural adjacent counties, is that in that situation, they're just more prone to feel threatened or feel that they can shoot a black youth and say, you know, I was in great fear of my life.
Okay. And I know you said that yesterday you were at a Black Lives Rally, Black Lives Matter rally, and you had some great, you know, turnout there. You said it was like around 400 people. Do you see the Black Lives Matter movement growing in the Columbus area, in the Central Ohio area, maybe doing it? Because like maybe not to the extent that we've seen it in other parts of the U.S., but will we probably see it more prominent? Because I know recently they busted up a city council meeting and were put on the news.
Yeah, actually the Black Lives Matter meeting shut down city council for the first time that I've ever heard of. And no one really, you know, knows for sure, but it may have been the first time in history, right? And it was over the shooting of Tyree King, you know, the 13-year-old we've been talking about. As for the movement, you know, which direction it's going to go with, one thing we found out yesterday, I mean, there's an old axiom, if the police put on riot gear and get on riot horses, someone's going to be beat and there's going to be a riot, but it's usually the police rioting. So, you know, they did run the horses up on us yesterday, which I felt was absolutely uncalled for. But I think they sent a message. Also, they appeared to have a sniper up on a bar across the street, and observation by people in military fatigues, which is another tendency that scares me in the U.S., the militarization of the police, you know, and using, you know, surplus federal materials from armored vehicles to helicopters. But I'd like to see the local police as they are where you live in Bexley and Upper Arlington. And it's a fact, I tell people my favorite law enforcement officer of all time was Andy of Mayberry. From classic TV, because, you know, you lock yourself in jail till you're sobered up, and there's one famous episode where there's a drunk hillbilly shooting his, you know, squirrel rifle, and Andy goes up there, and yeah, that's the drunk, well, he'll sober up and stop. But you don't crash the place with an armored vehicle and burn it to the ground and kill somebody who's drunk.
Okay. Well, I mean, that seems a little bit of an overreaction from the police, understandably. However, I have to ask, would this possibly be because of how the media has portrayed Black Lives Matter, or how we've seen, unfortunately, some people in the Black Lives Matter Act, which, by all accounts, I think even the Black Lives Matter leadership at certain points has condemned? Do you think that's part of what played into it, or do you think this is just a complete gross overreaction of the police in general?
Oh, no, I think there's a notion there were people around that time when Black Lives Matter was demonstrating, in a couple cases, former veterans, right, who had come back from the war, obviously suffering post-traumatic stress disorder. So in that case, while they weren't the leadership of Black Lives Matter, is that if you conflate those events, I mean, because they were shooting into, in one case, into the Black Lives Matter movement, trying to kill police that were nearby, absolutely unacceptable. So I think there's a perception among certain members of law enforcement that Black Lives Matter is a terrorist group, you know, that it's similar to the Black Panthers, and that they don't distinguish between, you know, mentally unbalanced people in that period that shot in, killed some police from the movement that has advocated nonviolent direct action.
Well, definitely. It seems like, unfortunately, you know, in the beginning we saw the Black Lives Matter coming out with this message, and that kind of just seemed like we had these, as you said, you know, mentally unstable people get the camera time, which, of course, as you know, better than anyone, being my politics and the media professor at one point, that the media can drive perception. So we definitely are kind of seeing this perception now that people don't want to, they're like, I can understand what Black Lives Matter is trying to say, but I can't associate with them because of the people in it. And it's kind of becoming, unfortunately, like how this third wave feminism is, that we're only seeing like 20% of women want to identify as feminist. How do you think this is something that we can rectify, if at all, for the Black Lives Matter movement?
Well, you know, the movement's got to work it out itself, and it's also, people need to be aware, as you're aware, of how the mainstream corporate media frames events. I mean, I suspect one of the reasons you're doing an audio podcast here, and you're engaged in social media, is because you don't like the news you're getting from the for-profit mass media. And I think we can't trust them. You know, we've got to do our own independent thinking, have our own debates and discourse, and why shows like this are so important.
I definitely agree with you, and you are right. This is part of the reason why I am in Being Libertarian, and we created this group, is my, you know, group of friends and associates I've met over time, we found that the media has just been driving a perception that's not true. Like, we saw this recent report from the bipartisan report that George Takei, of course, and other Democrats were circling around, that Johnson and Weld and the Libertarian Party had endorsed Hillary Clinton, but it never said anywhere in that. I think one of the most powerful statements he ever gave to me in class, and this was the reason right off the bat I got along with you, was day one you said, "I don't really care for MSN, I don't really care for Fox News, but I really don't like MSNBC." And I'm like, wait. What do you mean by this? And then you started talking to me, and you were saying, like, MSNBC is the mouthpiece of the DNC, and Fox News, you know, this. And then you go into all the different mainstream medias, and you gave me my pill to go down the rabbit hole. There we go.
Well, and again, it probably didn't take much. You were already aware of a lot of this, and particularly, you know, as a libertarian, you've got to realize how incredibly unfair the coverage of the Libertarian and the Green parties has been by the mainstream media. Just even in my own race here, I can't get them to mention in the newspaper, the Daily Monopoly here, the Columbus Dispatch, or I can't get them to say on TV that I'm even on the ballot. And then when they ignore me and don't invite me to the debates, it's like, well, your numbers aren't that good. And it's like, well, you know, the fact that you don't even mention that I'm running and what my platform is, that I would make this a Bill of Rights enforcement zone, and anyone who's the federal government is violating people's rights in Columbus, someone should be arrested. I mean, if they're spying on us illegally in violation of the Fourth Amendment, you know, as a prosecutor, I would indict them, you know, let them come down and prove that with the CIA or the NSA or whoever in the hell they're, DIA, whoever they're spying for.
Well, this is a perfect segue into the next, you know, part of the question, because we're going to go into the election. So, obviously, you, as my understanding is, you were the co-chair for the Green Party of Ohio, and I think still are. Okay, great. I just didn't know if you had to give up that seat when you ran for office. So with that understanding, of course, you are into the Green Party run. How well do you think she's doing this year as opposed to her last run in 2012? What are your projections? Do you think that she's possibly going to come out with in the election? What states is she doing well in as well?
Well, you know, I mean, the liberal states, particularly California, she'll probably get her largest bulk vote. But, you know, the polls are showing her, the mainstream polls, that, you know, 1-4%. But probably, you know, as high as 5%, just like I've seen Gary Johnson up as high as 12%. But part of the problem is usually, when they show those numbers, say Jill Stein at 4%, down to the 12%, they'll often say, well, we expect them to drop because they can't win. Well, you don't cover them. You know, you're telling everyone they can't win, which is presumptuous, but it's also a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think Jill Stein will do on par in it. With Nader, she'll probably get at least 3%, but the way the media has covered her really prevents her from getting 5%, which is what we need for her to get tens of millions of dollars in matching funds as a third-party candidate. It's what we call the 5% solution. If a third party gets 5% of the vote, it gets like $20 million the next presidential cycle in matching funds. So, that's what I'm hoping for, but realizing how this has played out in the media, I'm finding that it may be a bit of a stretch this year. Not as much for Gary Johnson, who, again, you know, when they framed that he didn't know what Aleppo was, they acted like he was totally unfit and unqualified.
Which is funny, because the interviewer himself, we had an article about, said he didn't think Trump or Clinton would know what it was either. And then we had Clinton going out saying Mosul's right next to Syria. And then we had Trump's didn't know what Brexit moment was. I mean, it's kind of interesting, as you said, with the media, you know, kind of perception.
Yeah, how they frame it and who's allowed to be taken seriously. But, you know, Gary Johnson was the governor of New Mexico, and he managed the state, and he's got a track record, and he should be judged on that. He has, in my mind, a saner foreign policy, and particularly a saner drug policy than either of the two major parties. And if he was treated fairly, as they were, and got their airtime, I think he would be a viable candidate at this point. You know, but both he and Jill Stein, you exclude from the debate. You know, how can you have a marketplace of ideas? How can you have a real democracy when you're cutting off actual choices that people need to hear from?
And we're also seeing this collusion from the media. I mean, I know you and I have talked about it in our class. We always theorized about it. But now we finally have WikiLeaks to prove us. So finally, the two of us that were looked at as the insane ones in the class have been vindicated. But it's kind of interesting how the mainstream media has also, you know, you have the Federal Election Commission, which ever since the League of Women Voters has overseen the debates. They didn't have a criteria for the 15% up until after Ross Perot, because the bipartisan, committee, not nonpartisan, bipartisan, decided, he's kind of a threat to both of us, so we're just going to make that 15% number. But when you look at the polls, the five polls they had, and the data of how they did it, we had an article on Being Libertarian about this, they excluded an entire voting group. They, excluded the entire 18 to 39 voting group, from my understanding, on the CNN poll. And there's a couple of other atrocious things, and it's kind of interesting that with the age of information now, we can, it used to be, this is a poll, margin of error, the margin of error looks cool, that's all right. But now we have the information to get the PDF, we can look at the statistics, and we can say, wait a minute, each of these margin of errors for the groups were around 8 to 9%. They just oversampled this one group to make it look okay. It's just kind of interesting how we're finding everywhere we turn that there's this collusion either with Republicans or the Democrats. They're just trying to shut down the third parties, whether it's Green or Libertarian. And do you see any ways that we can possibly rectify this? Because unfortunately, it's like an organization kind of from the government, but not, so it's private, but you get what I'm saying?
Oh, no, I know exactly what you're saying. And not only that, they're trying to cut off real debate in their own parties. You saw it in the past in the Republican Party and the way they treated Ron Paul. I'm absolutely convinced that they didn't count his votes fairly. Of course, Bernie Sanders. Bernie, who claimed the DNC, was rigging the election against him, and everyone, laughed at him. And then with WikiLeaks, we know exactly that the DNC was rigging the primaries against him and working for Hillary Clinton.
It was an amazing moment, I'll tell you that, when the WikiLeaks broke. And, they're trying to tell you the DNC is all happy and glorious, but they're going to be behind Hillary Clinton. But did you ever see that video where they actually had, I think it was Josh Fox of Gasland, recording himself, and it was only one-third full?
Oh, I do remember the controversy around Fox, yes.
It was definitely a sight to behold, because I don't think in any of the time I've looked at the elections, I've ever seen posts, picking the nominee, for a party to clear out like that. It's usually this is happy dance time. Everyone's partying with whatever band's playing.
Right. Well, yeah, and I was in Philadelphia, and I addressed both the New York delegation that started the walkout, I was able to provide them with some data on how I felt they'd stole the election from Bernie Sanders. And I also addressed the Progressive Democrats of America, many of them Democratic delegates from California. They were determined. WikiLeaks was doing its job in releasing information that week. And, people knew that Hillary Clinton had become the nominee of the Democratic Party based not on actual votes, but on cheating and stripping Bernie supporters off the voting rolls and looks like actually flipping votes with machinery. Someone appeared to be doing that on her behalf, right? 12 out of the 26 primaries were significantly outside the margin of error. Not a single Republican primary was outside the margin of error that indicates fraud. But 12 out of the 26 elections in the Democratic primary suggested massive voter irregularities.
This is, 2016 has definitely been an interesting year, and I want to ask you, because you are also editor-in-chief of the Columbus Free Press, being, a journalist yourself, we're seeing a lot of the comments now that, since WikiLeaks is releasing the information, they're saying that, they're letting Russia get involved into our elections. Now, first of all the evidence they have of it being Russia has been circumstantial at best. I've done my best as an IT guy to dig that up, and even John McAfee doesn't think it's Russia. and he's a cybersecurity legend. So it just seems like every IT person I'm talking to doesn't really think it's Russia. But they're also saying that WikiLeaks, by doing this, you know, they're getting involved in elections and all this. And they're saying, you know, they're basically saying they're not journalists. But it's kind of interesting, from my understanding is, because I'm only 25, but when your generation grew up and my parents' generation grew up, this was what the news did. They went into your trash. They found your secrets. They, you know, they found what the public needed to know. And now it's just seen, and now what do you think about the media today? Does it seem like they're still doing their job, or does it seem more like they're becoming mouthpieces for political agendas?
Well, you know, the Daily Beast there seems to exist as a direct propaganda arm of the Clintons, and most of these newspapers are really owned by and large by the 1% by oligarchs that often, you know, are going to back the status quo. They like Hillary Clinton because she's a neoliberal, although she's really not really, she brings in the government a tremendous amount.
She called herself a cold water girl at one point, let's remember.
Well, you know, I would not blame that on cold water. I mean, the man was...
Well, no, she actually said she was a cold water girl, so it's really saying something.
I know, yeah, it's, and we know, you know, she wasn't half that good. So, I mean, Goldwater was a very principled man. I think what defines Hillary Clinton is the lack of principles.
Well, definitely, as Penn Jillette says, you know, what's Hillary Clinton's motto going to be? Working together for me?
Yeah, and if you look at the Clinton Foundation, I mean, we know a variety of things now because of WikiLeaks. Any one of them you'd think would disqualify her as president, but I mean, when the Saudis give you $35 million, but then and you give them licenses to buy weapons from the United States government, state of the art weapons, but we now know that the Saudis created ISIS. It was their creation. Now,
the Saudis have been behind a lot of stuff, let's be honest.
Yeah, including 9/11. I mean, they financed it. That's what the 28 pages indicated. You know, they financed it with the help of the Pakistan and transferring the money to Mahatma Adda.
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of interesting. I mean, even, you know, I was talking to Newt Gingrich, I think it was on Tuesday, and I asked him about, you know, the foreign policy that we've been having, and he says the foreign policy of the past 15 years has been atrocious. Would you agree with that, or would you have a different answer?
Oh, I think, you know, I don't often like to admit, you know, being with Donald Trump, but, you know, their policy in Iraq seems to be absolutely a disaster. I think their policy in Libya, I don't know what their end is, like creating more jihadists. I mean, it seems like that's what the Barack Obama Clinton administration appears to have been good at. Also, item near and dear to libertarians, Ron Paul raised this when he was in the U.S. Congress, an 80% increase of U.S. military bases in foreign nations. I mean, it's the largest buildup of a imperial empire in recorded history. You know, we're now in at least 151 nations. Some studies indicate we may have troops, you know, posing as advisors in up to 181 nations. There's only 193 nations in the UN. So this massive, sprawling military empire that is never ending and doesn't seem to be for the benefit of the American people.
I mean, it's definitely interesting that you say the foreign buildup of our bases. I mean, I lived in Israel for a period of a year, 2009 to 2010, and I found it interesting that I was in Israel, which, you know, officially shouldn't have any U.S. boots on the ground there, but I remember going around Tel Aviv and stuff, just chilling around, and seeing a few men in uniform at times from wearing the U.S. uniform, and I was like, That's a bit interesting, because it stands out, digital camo versus just green.
Well, yeah, now there's a lot of countries like that where we're not officially there, or it's not officially a base. It's an outpost, or they rotate the troops every 4 months so we can deny actually being there, because there's rules. Usually they have to be there more than 4 months, the same troops, to call it a military base. But, we're the new Rome. We've got troops everywhere, and the question is, can we afford it? Does it make us safer? It's just like with the world's largest police state, you know, which I want to rein in as prosecutor in Franklin County, is, you know, if you've locked up 25% of the world's population in your prisons, many of them nonviolent drug users in there for drug possession, something is fundamentally wrong with your country.
Well, definitely. I know the I volunteer as well for assisting, you know, inmates that happen to be Jewish, just because I'm Jewish, and unfortunately we have a lot of our rights denied when we're in prison. So I definitely help out. Now, it's an interesting to see, even amongst Jewish inmates, or really across the board, period, how many people are incarcerated for nonviolent crimes that I kind of am just like, it's a personal choice. I don't really see why the state weighs in here. And then the state tells us it's for our good and our protection, but they're using our money for it, and it's increasingly expensive. And we're starting to see, of course, you know, the privatization of prisons, and unfortunately the privatization that we're seeing today isn't even done in the proper way, because it's still a government-run prison, just horribly mismanaged, if you think about it.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more.
I mean, we had our one of my friends on the team, he's an economics minor. He looked into it, and he's like, yeah, the prison systems that are private in America shouldn't be calling themselves that. Because a true private system wouldn't be relying upon, you know, status quos to have X amount of, you know, percentage filled in there, or else you get charged this much. Because then you're basically making your profit based on the suffering of others. And I know we've had cases, I think there's been some here in Columbus as well, pay-to-play with judges, basically putting people in these prisons and getting kickbacks.
Yeah, and there was, of course, the famed or infamous case in Pennsylvania with the juvenile judgment judges who were getting direct kickbacks. But, yeah, the Correction Corporation of America, CCA, which brought in hardcore violent felons in the Washington, D.C. area and was referring to its jail cells as profit units, and were mixing them in with nonviolent felons, with the predicted results of, you know, rapes, stabbings, deaths, because they're trying to make money by locking people up for things like drug possession, people using drugs, you know, it's their body. Why are we engaged in mass incarceration? And then you got the problem in a lot of these prisons, they actually drug the prisoners themselves.
I know, it's just insane the kind of abuses you hear from your side of what I've read of your reports and what I've seen, you know, assisting people, even though I'm on the IT side, I meet these people often. And you realize that these people have, pardon my language, had their lives fucked up by the state for nothing really, anything different than what would be a personal choice. What's the incarceration rate for, like, drug use? It's like 60% or something like that. It's insane.
And again, also at the just at the jail level, I mean, we're still putting in hundreds of thousands of people are doing jail time for small amounts of marijuana that's legalized in some states and or medically regulated in other states. That makes no sense. And one of the things, when I run for prosecutor, I intend to, as prosecutor, not to prosecute anyone for drug possession. And so you'll get de facto decriminalization of drugs. I mean, you use that if you arrest somebody, you use it to see if they need treatment or to make sure that no harm's coming to them. You don't put them into prison and hope they kick heroin in there.
Right. I mean, I've actually heard from a lot of the inmates that, well, former inmates, of course, because they're already out of prison when I'm speaking to them, that they said it was sometimes easier to get drugs in prisons than it was than outside. It's kind of really sad when you hear things like that. They'd say that, you know, they'd see people shooting up and nodding off from heroin, you know, well, not shooting up, but, like, whatever they use in the prisons, however, because I'm not into that. But that kind of goes into the next question. We have a huge heroin epidemic, as we know right now, in Ohio. Mm-hmm. So, of course, this goes into the whole drug question. Now, of course, you know, conservatives are pushing back, and they're saying, well, we need to strengthen the war on drugs, put more money into it, which, of course, you know, as we've talked about, leads into more militarization and things like that. So it kind of just is spiraling down the toilet and not really helping. So what would you see as a more effective solution for Ohio to get over this heroin epidemic we're having? And a part of that question is, do you think this in part had something to do as maybe a delayed reaction from Mike DeWine rapidly shutting down the pill mills and not getting those people the ability to get proper treatment?
Yeah, I mean, I've, since 1992 when I ran for Congress against John Kasich, at that time I was a Democrat, I've been for full legalization of all drugs. And again, although I don't advocate people use narcotics, I realize that the rise of the prison industrial complex, and the state itself, what it's doing with incarceration rates is far worse than the drug use itself. You know, I think we got to make sure that there's treatment available. I think we've got to make sure that people who use heroin have access to clean needles. Most of the studies show that they outgrow it after a decade or so. And in England and other places where heroin is a medical problem, not a criminal problem, as many people are actually working full time, even though they're heroin addicts. So I think looking at harm reduction, and the other thing is we really should be concentrating on the drug dealers connected often to the CIA who bring their stuff in by the plane load and by the cargo container on ship. The heroin traffic and importing of heroin is not the result of some drug mule with 10 balloons in his belly. This stuff's coming in by the boatload and plane load.
It's just kind of interesting. You mentioned, you know, the CIA. Again, we're having the state saying, we have to end the war on drugs, but we've seen through the Reagan, Clinton, and such years that the CIA was behind bringing drugs into the USA. So it's kind of like we're seeing the FBI and DEA fight it on one front, and then the FBI and DEA will turn around and then say, okay, CIA, you do your thing, sell your crack in the neighborhoods.
Yeah, it does appear to be that. And most of the drug dealing on a large scale in the U.S. has always been tied to some covert operation by the CIA. In America, during the Vietnam War, which came out of Laos, Long Chen, and really involved bringing opium and heroin into Vietnam, the Philippines, and Thailand, with American soldiers being a target. 13% of them were addicted to heroin during the Vietnam War in the early 1970s. The crack cocaine epidemic that the Contras, friends of the CIA, the Contras, who were supposed to be fighting the Sandinistas, but found it was far more lucrative to bring guns and cocaine into the United States. And, of course, our allies in Afghanistan, you know, we put together a government with Karzai in Afghanistan that involve so-called warlords, but the term we left off is they were opium warlords, right, from the Golden Crescent. The Taliban had destroyed a lot of the opium production, and the United States deliberately looked the other way. So there's a little irony here with the CIA allowing its friends and helping them transship drugs into the United States while at the same time, you know, supposedly we're fighting some bogus war on drugs. I think ultimately people will realize that it's all a big joke and move forward to legalizing drugs and making sure help's available for people that get addicted to opiums, not jail available for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's just interesting, you know, being from the Green Party to the Libertarian Party, that, you know, you look at the different perspectives, and you see that the government's been playing, like, two sides of every war, basically, when you look back. I mean, we saw the whole morality war that we saw for the past decades during when my parents grew up, that, you know, he would repress your sexuality and all that. But when our soldiers are over in Asia, we're going to set up whorehouses for them. You know.
Yeah, and the term hooker itself comes from, you know, the Civil War and General Hooker, who, you know, let prostitutes follow his troops.
I did not even know that. You learn something new every day. So I want to, while we wrap this up, I want to hear, what is your entire platform as opposed to Zach Klein and Ron O'Brien? What would you do differently, and possibly how would you affect these changes?
Well, a lot of them, you know, since the prosecutor doesn't arrest people, but I do prosecute people. So if I say I'm not going to prosecute anyone for drug possession, even though it's a felony and a narcotic, I mean, that essentially creates de facto decriminalization. And if I say I'm going to concentrate my limited sources on really violent felons, not on people that are making life choices I might not agree with, but really if they're harming anyone, it's only themselves, that would be my approach. Also, I want it to be a Bill of Rights enforcement zone, is that people's rights, the free speech and to demonstrate, are to be protected by the police. You're not supposed to, you know, run riot horses up on top of them and beat them and mace them. So in that case, I would arrest the police because they're the ones instigating the violence. So I would treat the police equally. I would afford them equal rights like other citizens. I wouldn't give them special rights to brutalize American citizens. They're exercising their constitutional rights. So also, I would, if I find anyone illegally spying on American citizens in Franklin County, I'll arrest them. Now, it'd be up to them to reveal to the court if they work for any of these secret agencies, intelligence agencies, NSA, you know, CIA, DIA, etc. But I have no trouble arresting somebody who's illegally spying on a citizen in Franklin County. And if any polluters are, you know, polluting us from upriver, I'll make sure people have a right to drink clean air and clean water. So my approach, again, is to protect the fundamental rights of citizens, you know, be they the First, the Second, through the 10th Amendment, and to make sure that government leaves people alone, as opposed to creating an authoritarian spy state.
Well, I appreciate you taking very much some of your precious time. I know you've been so constrained with your busy, hectic schedule. I know you've got my personal vote, and I just want to say thank you for coming on the show and letting us hear your message.
All right, I'm really glad I got to do it. The show gives a a lot of time to really expand and discuss stuff in detail, and that's so important in this era of, you know, 30-second sound bites and bumper sticker slogans.
Well, you know, I would definitely love to have you back on for in the future, so we would love to hear more from you, because I know after my classes, I have always loved spending time. We would smoke our briar pipes together outside of class, talking
right
about all the political discussions. But definitely, we'll have to meet up again sometime for a pipe, and we'll discuss some more, and I would love to have you back on.
Now, wasn't that your grandfather's pipe you gifted me?
Yes, I did.
I still got it, and so let's put it to good use. I appreciate it.
Definitely. Well, this has been Alone Gannon with Being Libertarian. I hope everyone has a lovely day.